This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, July 26, 2012. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, a new report says New York police violated international law in their crackdown on Occupy protesters.
We also have instances of physical assault against protesters. There's a number of documented instances of police hitting, kicking, punching, pushing, pulling protesters.
As Congress debates funding for agriculture, consumer and environmental groups warn that giving more power to biotech giants like Monsanto and Dow Chemical threatens small farmers. And we'll go to India, where thousands of Chukma people may get citizenship after a six-decade-long struggle. Those stories and more coming up after this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. Tomorrow, the Olympic Games begin in London, and one of the major corporate sponsors is Dow Chemical. This is not sitting well with survivors of India's Bhopal gas disaster. Dow now owns the company that was responsible for the 1984 leak, which killed thousands of local residents. Activists have been calling on the Olympic Committee to drop Dow as a sponsor without luck, and today they've organized an event to draw attention to the plight of the community. FSRN's Shuria Niazi reports from Bhopal.
A day ahead of the London Games, five organizations of Bhopal gas disaster survivors in India jointly organized the Bhopal Special Olympics in protest of their sponsorship by Dow Chemical. Dow is the present owner of Union Carbide, which owned the plant in Bhopal. Local residents say Union Carbide did not fully clean up or compensate local residents after the disaster and are now looking to Dow to finish the job. But Dow has continued to evade civil, criminal and environmental liabilities inherited from Union Carbide. The Bhopal Special Olympics was held in a stadium right behind the abandoned Union Carbide factory. Children affected by the contamination, many bound to wheelchairs, took part in various events including crab race, 25-meter sprint and assisted walking. Contrary to the opening ceremony at the London Olympics that is expected to highlight British national pride, the Bhopal Special Olympics opened with songs and dances, drawing attention to issues that demonstrate a darker side of the Olympic Games. Shuria Niazi, FSRN, Bhopal.
Cleanup efforts continue in Beijing after mass floods swept through the city last weekend, when as much as 16 inches of rain fell in a short period of time in the region. Today, the Chinese government announced the death toll at 77, dozens higher than reported earlier in the week. Reports estimate that 60,000 homes were damaged in the high water yesterday. Following widespread criticism of how local officials were handling the situation, the mayor of China's capital resigned. After an order from the International Criminal Court last week, Senegal is moving ahead with plans to bring former Chadian president Hissène Habré to trial for crimes against humanity. Representatives from the African Union and the government of Senegal have proposed the formation of a special court in Dakar. Habré, who has been referred to as Africa's Pinochet, is accused of killing hundreds of thousands of people and has been living in Senegal for decades. FSRN's Alpha Jallo reports from Dakar.
It is now clear that former Chadian President Hissène Habré is not likely to be extradited to the International Criminal Court in Belgium, following an agreement between Senegalese President Macky Sall and the African Union to try him in Senegal. 4 days of intensive talks resulted in a draft agreement to create a special court. According to Senegal's Director of Justice, the court will handle instruction, investigations, trials, and appeals, and will consist of mainly Senegalese and other African judges. The proposal is still awaiting final approval. President Sall recently reiterated his commitment to put Habré on trial rather than extraditing him to The Hague. Meanwhile, some civil society groups in Senegal say this is a gross violation of Habré's right as a refugee in the country. The former Chadian president was overthrown in 1990 and has spent more than 20 years in Senegal living a free life. Alpha Jallo, Free Speech Radio News, Dakar, Senegal.
The U.S. Senate approved an extension to tax cuts yesterday that would maintain the current tax rate for middle and working class Americans. The Senate version of the legislation will allow taxes to increase for the wealthiest. It passed 51 to 48. The bill will likely not gain traction in the Republican-led House. But the House did pass the Audit the Fed legislation. The bill, whose primary sponsor is Ron Paul, would lead to an audit of the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve Transparency Act has the support from many Democrats, including Dennis Kucinich.
We're saying, oh, don't go into the Fed. It'll be political. Yes, it's political. We have unemployment because of politics. We have people losing their homes because of politics. We have banks getting uncalculated amounts of money from the Federal Reserve, and we don't even know about it. Meanwhile, people can't get a loan to keep their home or keep their business. Audit the Fed? You bet we should audit the Fed. We have to have accountability.
The Senate is not expected to support the legislation. This weekend, a milestone is expected in the movement to reopen the American West to migratory animals on the Heart Mountain National Antelope Refuge in Oregon. The last sections of hundreds of miles of barbed wire fence will be removed. Volunteers have been working for nearly 20 years to take down 275 miles of the fence. The wires and posts are left over from days when cattle grazed the area, but refuge manager Jeff McKay says it's been a hazard to antelope.
They're here on the summer range, so they need to be able to move off the refuge in winter when our conditions up here are just much too harsh for them. And we removed the fence just to allow these animals to move freely across the refuge where they want to for feed and water.
The final volunteer push begins today on the nearly 300,000-acre reserve in eastern Oregon. Initiatives to remove old barbed wire fences from natural areas are ongoing across the West. And that's headlines for FSRN. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Doreen Marina in Los Angeles. Cities and police departments are under more scrutiny for violence used against Occupy protesters. A new report says New York police violated international law by using aggressive and excessive force. The report is the first in a nationwide investigation from the Protest and Assembly Rights Project, researched by civil liberties and human rights experts at seven law clinics across the U.S. It calls for an independent investigation into the incidents documented, which include arbitrary arrests, late-night raids, the improper use of batons and chemical sprays, and failures to ensure accountability. The findings have also been submitted to the U.S. Department of Justice and the United Nations. For more, we're joined by Catherine Glenn, adjunct professor of law at Fordham Law School and co-author of the report. Professor Glenn, welcome to FSRN.
Thank you for having me.
One of the most striking things about the Occupy protests was the physical presence on public space, the direct action and access to public parks or city halls or other space. Begin by talking about the international law or standards that protect this right.
International human rights law places a great deal of emphasis on the importance of the human rights to public assembly. It's seen as one of the fundamental civil rights, political rights, as it is in U.S. law, I would add. And because of that, there's a great deal of protection given to the concept that people have a right to use public spaces, not just for circulation, for getting around, but also a space for participation, for political activity in itself. And what you see in the international law, in case law, and also in statements of principles issued by various bodies like the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, is a great deal of emphasis on protecting that right and concern whenever states attempt to curtail that right. Essentially, states are only permitted to curtail the right to free assembly and free expression, which is a very closely related right, under a very narrow set of circumstances that they have to justify in quite detailed fashion.
And again, some of those rights that you're describing, this report catalogs 130 specific alleged incidents of excessive police force in the response by authorities to these protests. In other cities, we saw the use of less lethal measures such as chemical agents, beanbag, or gas canister projectiles on protesters. What did you find in New York?
In New York, we saw, I would say, several types of worrying force. One of them would be the use of batons inappropriately to strike protesters. Various U.S. use of force policies set fairly strict rules on when you're allowed to use force, to swing a baton in certain ways. We also saw police using barricades as weapons, so those metal barricades that you see sometimes lining sidewalks. We have a number of instances documented where police picked those up and pushed them into the crowd of protesters as sort of a battering ram, for lack of a better word. We also have instances of physical assault against protesters. There's a number of documented instances of police hitting, kicking, punching, pushing, pulling protesters. So all of those are included in the report.
How about the surveillance of protesters and the infiltration of activist groups?
Sure. So the surveillance of protesters, in New York, the NYPD is under a set of rules called the Hanshu Decree, which was passed in response to illegal surveillance of political activists in the past. And one thing that we've seen that's been particularly worrying is the use of video surveillance. In theory, New York police are only supposed to turn video cameras on protesters when criminal activity is either imminent or ongoing. What we've seen during the Occupy protests is virtually constant surveillance of Occupy protesters. The video cameras are always on. There were permanent video cameras set up at Zuccotti Park. In terms of infiltration, plainclothes officers have been spotted at numerous protests. They're not always that hard to identify. And then we've also seen several worrying examples of police using open warrants for various people to go in and conduct arrests and then interrogation afterwards when, A, there's no direct connection between the warrant itself and the activity that the person is engaged in for protest, and B, there's no indication that charges were then brought after that interaction with the police, suggesting that the warrant was perhaps not the actual cause for wanting to contact the protester.
One of the specific reforms called for in this report is to change New York's mask law, which allows police to arrest people merely on the basis of wearing a mask. This report also serves as a complaint filed with the Department of Justice, the United Nations, and authorities in New York. What other reforms are you calling for?
Well, one of the key reforms that we'd like to see put into place is the establishment of an independent inspector general for the NYPD. According to the New York Civil Liberties Union, the NYPD is the only major police department in the entire country without independent oversight. And the establishment of an inspector general could do things like recommend policy reform within the NYPD. They could conduct investigations. They could recommend various changes to make the department more effective. And they could also report to the public, to the city council, and to the mayor about their findings and their recommendations. They'd also have subpoena power, which is important because most of the oversight bodies established for the NYPD at present don't have any power like that. So they could compel testimony of someone in order to conduct their investigations.
This report focuses on New York, but other reports are coming that document other cities. Is that right?
Yes, there will be reports forthcoming later this summer and then also in the fall focusing on Charlotte, North Carolina, the Bay Area, which includes Oakland and San Francisco, and then also Boston.
And this report is called Suppressing Protest, Human Rights Violations in the U.S. Response to Occupy Wall Street. Catherine Glenn is adjunct professor of law at Fordham Law School. She's also a co-author of the report. Professor Glenn, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
As lawmakers in Congress continue to debate funding for farmers and agriculture, consumer and environmental groups are raising concerns about measures that put more power in the hands of biotech giants like Monsanto, Dow Chemical, and Bayer Crop Science. Opponents say sustainable farmers, public health, and the environment could be at risk. FSRN's Vic Bedoyan has more.
One of the measures is in the 2013 Agriculture Appropriations Bill. Section 733 would prohibit federal courts from stopping the sale and planting of GE crops that were illegally approved. It would also allow biotech companies to continue to plant and sell GE crops, even if the USDA found previously unrecognized risks associated with it. There are also provisions favorable to biotech companies in the 2012 Farm Bill, including a measure that would allow transgenic crops to be planted before rigorous analysis by the U.S. Department of Agriculture is complete. Colin O'Neill is with the Center for Food Safety, one of dozens of groups trying to stop these measures.
The biotech riders to the Farm Bill have the potential to eliminate the critical roles of our most important environmental laws. by outlawing actually the reviews of GE crop impacts under the National Environmental Policy Act, the Endangered Species Act, or other environmental laws. And instead, the biotech industry has offered a very cursory and initial environmental analysis, and that would be required instead of the broader, more robust environmental assessments.
Biotechnology advocates counter that transgenic crop traits enable farmers to grow more food more efficiently. Kent Bradford is a plant scientist at the University of California, Davis. He says that more restrictive regulations are unnecessary.
The fact is that many of these crops were reviewed and released by the USDA after their review, and then subsequently lawsuits forced them to go back and do a full environmental impact statement. In every case so far, the full environmental impact statement has completely verified the findings of the so-called shorter-term or environmental assessments.
But critics contend the existing regulatory process can be flawed, pointing to problems with Starlink corn and unauthorized GE rice contaminating the U.S. food supply. Opponents say GE crops will continue to threaten food grown by sustainable and organic farmers. O'Neill with the Center for Food Safety says another rider in the Farm Bill under consideration by Congress would set an acceptable level of GE contamination in non-GE crops.
This would leave organic and conventional growers who are found to have contamination, if they're under the levels that are deemed okay, this would offer little recourse and could risk the loss of GE-sensitive domestic and export markets, as well as the loss of biodiversity.
While the biotech provisions may get passed in the House version, there is less support in the Senate. Consumer groups say they'll continue to pressure lawmakers to leave these industry-supported measures out of the legislation. Vic Bedoyan, FSRN.
Today marks the 22nd anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act, the landmark civil rights legislation that established protections against discrimination and accessibility requirements for transportation, workplaces, and accommodations. While progress has been made over the last two decades, challenges remain. Nearly 5 million people with disabilities live below the poverty line, and just over 20% participate in the labor force. Accessibility is also still an issue. Rights advocates are highlighting resistance by the hotel industry to delay installing lifts in swimming pools that assist people with disabilities in accessing the water. Mark Perriello is president of the American Association of People with Disabilities, one of the groups that just launched a boycott against hotels, including Marriott, Kimpton, and Comfort Suites.
The hotel industry, led by its trade associations, pressured the Department of Justice, pressured Congress to delay and revise its rule requiring fully accessible fixed pool lifts, and lobbied Congress to pass a bill to cut an exemption out of the ADA or stop the Civil Rights Division from doing its job.
Perriello says the American Hotel and Lodging Association and the Asian American Hotel Owners Association have been involved in lobbying Congress and pressured the DOJ to delay implementation of the pool lift requirement to 2013. Some hotels with less accessible portable lifts were grandfathered in.
People with disabilities are already getting less than what we pay for. When you go to a hotel with a pool you can't use because the owners didn't install a lift, they don't give you a discount. They just give you less than what you paid for. So we're saying no. No, you can't have my money to lobby against me. And no, I won't be a second-class customer.
Colleen Kelly Starkloff is co-director of the Starkloff Disability Institute. She said the issue affects her personally as it prevented her late husband from fully accessing hotel amenities with his family.
We traveled all over this country. Many of our trips were car trips, but always our end destinations required that we stayed in hotels or motels. At no time was my husband able to get into the pool with our kids. He had to sit next to the pool on the pool deck, watching our kids playing in the water. And sometimes I'd get in with them, sometimes I'd sit on the pool deck to be next to my husband. But at no time could he enjoy the full opportunities that the hotel or the motel had to offer to all the rest of the guests. This is second-class citizenship.
Starkloff and other disability rights groups say complying with ADA also makes business sense, as many disability conferences are held at hotels across the country. The groups are highlighting the hotels that do have accessible pools and urging people to take their business there. In Georgia, prisoners continue a hunger strike that started in June. They're protesting inhumane conditions, including prolonged solitary confinement. It's the same prison where one of the largest prisoner work strikes in U.S. history took place in 2010 and where Troy Davis was executed. FSRN Sacagawea Hall brings us this update.
After 36 days of refusing food, most of the men have ended their hunger strike. Of the 10 that were known to be on strike, two are entering their 45th day, Kelvin Stevenson and Miguel Jackson. Last week, family members and advocates demonstrated at the Department of Corrections headquarters to support the prisoners' demands. They're asking for a restoration of family visitation and communication, access to proper hygiene and personal property, and medical treatment of injuries. Delma Jackson, the wife of hunger striker Miguel Jackson, received a letter last week terminating her visitation rights. Jackson believes this is in retaliation for persistent advocacy for her husband and other prisoners. Speaking to FSRN by cell phone, she questioned the motives behind the decision.
You don't want me to visit with my husband. Why? Why don't you want me to visit with my husband? What are you trying to hide? What is it that you don't want me to know? What is it that you don't want the pet taxpayers to know?
The prison has also made it difficult for other prisoners' family members. Bernice Watley O'Kelly, mother of Sean Watley, says her visitation and all communication have been cut off for 8 months now. Like Miguel Jackson, Sean Watley was also suspected of leading the 2010 work strike. Both were severely beaten, and Watley has been in solitary confinement for over a year. Watley O'Kelly says she does not think anyone will intervene, although family members have appealed to the Department of Correction Commissioner and the governor.
And they're not going to step in. They're not going to step in. They're not going to help. It's going to take the families of the inmates and the loved ones that has got the nerve to step out and say enough is enough.
Jackson and Watley O'Kelly say they will continue taking action and hope that anyone with a loved one in prison will join them. Sacagawea Hall, FSRN, Atlanta.
In India, the Chukma people of Arunachal Pradesh state have been fighting for citizenship for more than six decades. They fled Bangladesh in the 1960s. Now there are more than 60,000 Chukmas in the state. This year, India's national government seems likely to finally grant some of them citizenship, but challenges remain. FSRN's Gayatri Parameswaran and Felix Gayatka met the Chukmas to hear their stories.
Vishwamitra Chakma is returning home after a day's work on the fields in Dayan village. He's 58 and was born in Bangladesh. But this village in India has been his home for almost half a century.
I don't remember clearly how old I was when my family migrated. I might have been about 8 years old. There were so many of us, mother, father, four brothers and three sisters. I remember what my parents told me then. They told me that our houses had drowned underwater. That was because of a dam being built in Bangladesh. We couldn't live there anymore.
In 1964, construction of the Kaptai hydroelectric dam displaced nearly 100,000 Chakmas. A large number of them sought refuge in India. Another reason why they left was religious persecution, says Bimal Kanti Chakma, one of the tribe's leaders.
We are Buddhists, and it would be difficult to live in a Muslim country being non-Muslims. Before India's partition, we were citizens of India. After partition, the territory we lived in was handed over to East Pakistan. So religious persecution is another reason why we were compelled to migrate. We came to Arunachal Pradesh with due consultation with the Indian administration at that point.
The Chakmas crossed over the border legitimately with valid migration certificates. And although their migration was legal, they were not recognized as Indian citizens. Sanjay Chakma lives with his family in a small hut in the village. His neighborhood is also home to many other Chakma families. Though Sanjay was born in Arunachal Pradesh, he doesn't feel at home here because he's a Chakma.
Sometimes I am sad that I was born a Chakma. Sometimes I wonder why I am a Chakma. The other tribes in the region view us with such disdain. We are humans too, but we are denied the rights of humans, whether it is in official bureaucracy or something else. If you ask around, you will find enough cases of Chakmas being beaten up on the streets by people from other tribes. We don't get respect at the workplace. We have no other option but to endure how we are treated.
Sanjay became a father to a baby boy a few months ago. Although he had all the right papers, he hasn't been able to get a birth certificate for his son.
I had all the documents ready and I filled out all of the forms and I went to the office. But the officer in charge wasn't around. The notice board at the office clearly states that they have to be present on Tuesday and Wednesday to register birth certificates. The officer was never present on these days. We have heard that there is political influence asking the office not to issue birth certificates to Chakmas.
In 1992, the national government affirmed that the Chakmas have a legitimate claim to Indian citizenship. Despite that, in 2004, the state government granted citizenship only to around 1,500 Chakmas out of a total Chakma population of around 65,000. The state government refused to comment to FSRN on the issue. Chakmas make up around 7.5% of the state's population, but local politics have kept the community marginalized. Chakma campaigners say that other indigenous tribes who have dominated local politics for decades view them as outsiders and criminals. But things may be about to change. 2 years ago, India's national government formed a parliamentary committee to look into Chakma citizenship issues. Bimal Kanti, who is a member of the Committee for Citizenship Rights of the Chakmas, says the fight is ongoing.
So, government se dialogue ho raha hai.
We are in dialogue with the government, and I hope that the dialogue will be fruitful. Right now, only a very few of us have voting rights, but this right has to cover many more people. We are also fighting to have the right to contest elections here.
It's a big step forward, but it doesn't go all the way. The government plans to grant citizenship only to those Chakmas who came to India between 1964 and 1969. According to government records, that's just under 15,000 people out of a current total Chakma population of over 65,000. The fate of refugees who came after 1969 is still not clear. With Felix Gatkar, this is Gayatri Parmeshwaran, FSRN, Arunachal Pradesh, India.
That's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kopp. Headlines editor was Jess Burns. Our technical production team at KPFA Berkeley is Rose Katapchi and Janine Etter. Washington, D.C. intern is Neth Smith-Savadoff. Our theme music was composed and produced for FSRN by Alan Weatherhead. We welcome your questions, comments, and news tips. Write to us, comments@fsrn.org. For more news stories, specials, and our documentaries, visit our website, fsrn.org, and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/fsrn. Thanks for listening. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marino.